All right, everybody, we're back with the First Baptist Church Brookhaven podcast, episode 5.
Love it.
Yes, sir. We still set up in our little living room here in the sanctuary, and we've got it nice and cool here today. I've got a couple awesome dudes with us today. Over on mic one, the Right Reverend Chris Layton. Say hey, Chris.
Hey, hey.
What up? Yay, good to have you, man. Thank you for carving out some time. As we're recording, Chris has been getting ready for...
big night of worship.
Yeah, really. Y'all are back a week early.
School is starting.
Yeah, tomorrow.
In 2 days.
Friday. Of course, when you're hearing this, our regular Wednesday activities all in full start August 6th. So whenever you're listening to this, we're on July 30th today.
July 30th, yeah.
So Chris likes to come back 1 week early for just a night of worship. And so he really did have to carve out some time to be with us today. I appreciate that, Brother Chris. Over here on mic two, his son, Jeremiah Layton. Say hey, Jeremiah.
What's going on? It's good to be here.
So, did you get recovered yesterday? I heard you needed a little extra rest.
Yeah, I was in bed until about 3:30 yesterday.
Oh, Love and Lincoln took it out of you, huh?
Love and Lincoln, yeah.
Adrenaline dump.
Yeah, when it wears off, all of a sudden you're like, I need to sleep a little bit. How did Love and Lincoln go, Jeremiah?
I mean, it went fantastic. It was just cool to see how, like, every year Love and Lincoln has grown and gotten better, and like, I don't even know how it could get better. Like, we've been having conversations about that, like, man, how's it going to get better next year? But we expect that it will, because it has the past 3 years. It's been awesome just to see the willingness of the students to go out and work in the community, and then really the willingness this year to go out and share the gospel, because we got to send out evangelism teams.
I had a cool moment Sunday in the worship service, and Chris, you may be having these moments all along, but this past week y'all shared about Love and Lincoln, and you came up after Brother Chris introduced you. When you came to the pulpit and you started talking, I saw a man. It was wild. I said, Jeremiah is a man. He talks like a man. He's carrying himself like a man. And he's leading like a man. I said, man, he's not asking us to do anything up here. He's telling us what to do up here. And I loved it. I loved your testimony Sunday.
I did notice the little edge he had.
He did. He was like, I'm not putting up with any laziness in this Christian journey anymore. Yeah. You know, I'm overplaying it, but. I said, man, we're looking at a man. Mm-hmm. And it was really neat.
Thank you.
Yeah. So our goal here today, just for the next few minutes, is to supplement what is going to happen on August 3rd. Of course, by the time y'all listen to this, we will already have had our International Missions Celebration. And in that August 3rd AM worship service, we were able to hear from five different First Baptist members who went on foreign soil in 2025. We've taken basically five different trips. Two of those trips were to the same country, Team A, Team B. But Jeremiah had a really interesting summer, and he was able to share, you know, some of that with us Sunday, but we wanted to give some space to hear some of the things, you know, that you experienced and that you want to tell us, and that maybe we didn't get to do that Sunday morning. Yeah. So, Jeremiah's mission is a little more unique than the others that we heard, in that there's some security risks, really. I don't know how to articulate it. So yes. Just jump in there. Safety concerns, how would you...
Yeah, I mean, well, I went to a closed country, so, it's very, like, I'm not allowed really to say where it was, other than it was in South Asia, And so where we were, it was not illegal to be a Christian, but sharing the gospel is illegal. So
there's a risk factor to even publicly saying the area that you went to. Mm-hmm. And First Baptist is not, unfamiliar with hosting missionaries, because we've got several missionaries around the world. And when they show up back in Brookhaven and we have them in a worship service, we have to redact their names. We have to edit out their footage. We can't live stream them because they're at risk when they go back home, So we're kind of familiar with that. But it's a closed country, and that's a designation that I guess IMB gives a country. So in South Asia.
How long has Christianity been in this country?
So the country I was in, it's been in the country really for around 40 years only. But it's been crazy to see the growth of when it first, when I was very young, there were about 12 churches in all of the country. And just in the past 40 years, it's grown to where there are around 8,000 churches, 600,000 believers. So,
but there are still many, many people who have yet to hear the gospel.
Many.
Now, so let's dig down just in some details of what you can tell us. And I think it would be cool, Brother Nick, I can't tell you all that.
Yeah.
If I told you that, I'd have to kill you. Stuff like that. So I may ask a question you can't answer. Mm-hmm. And just tell us, okay?
Right.
So you went with the BSU at Mississippi Gulf Coast Community College, mm-hmm. where you were a student.
Yeah.
And you're done there, right?
Yeah, I've finished up there. I'll be headed up to state.
So. Headed up to where again?
Mississippi State.
Oh, my gracious. Yeah. Okay. Everybody's going up there, yeah. So how many from the BSU went? How many?
From the Mississippi BSU overall, there were 10 students that went.
So statewide, mm-hmm. BSU sent 10 students.
Yeah.
And what was the name of the program that y'all were involved in?
So we were on the Himalayan Summer Internship.
Okay.
Is what it was
so that
called.
Gives us just a little more context.
Bit of, yeah.
So cool. All right. So the Himalayas are not in America.
Nope.
They're a long ways away.
Yeah.
All right. So in total travel time, how long did it take you to get over there?
Ooh, it took, I think it was 36 hours of travel. The longest single flight we had was from Dallas to Qatar, and that was 16 hours.
All right. So let's start at Hillcrest Drive.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to where you went? All right. So you fly out of where?
New Orleans.
You go to New Orleans.
Yep.
Your parents take you down there.
Yep.
And then you hop on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to where first?
We flew to Dallas first. Had a layover there for a little bit, and that's where we met all the other interns from Mississippi. And some of them, when we got there, we had about a 2-hour layover. Some of them had been there for about 12 hours.
Yes.
So it was rough.
Dallas is big, though. I guess you could spend some
and,
time.
And so then. From there, we flew over to Qatar.
And that was the 16-hour
flight. And that was a 16-hour flight.
All right, I want to pause just a second. Dad.
Yeah.
How was it leaving him at the New Orleans airport?
That's a good question. Because we initially thought that we would spend a little time with him at the airport.
Okay.
But it turned out that we pulled up to the airport, dropped him off, and said goodbye.
Right there.
Right
it all
there.
Happened a lot faster.
It all
faster
happened
than
a lot faster than we were expecting. And I think Kristen was more caught off guard by that than anybody, because when we left Jeremiah, She was pretty emotional.
Sure, I would think so. Were kind of. She was probably kind of hoping for the, I get to see him take off, from a window or something. And
yeah, looking back, it may have been better that it turned out to be like
and,
that.
And I mean, for me too, it was this is the first time I left the country. It was my first flight going from New Orleans to Dallas.
So that's important,
I just got dropped off, and I was like, what am I doing? I don't know. I went, and luckily I found Landon, and he helped me figure out, like, how to get my ticket and everything. Sure. I didn't know how to do any of that. So I was just like, where am I
right now? That's amazing. So yeah. Not only going to South Asia,
mm-hmm.
you had never
Left flown. The country, never flown.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess for mom and dad, that could be a little unnerving. But you got there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 16 hours from Dallas to Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then from Qatar, what can you tell us?
From Qatar, we flew to the capital of the place we were.
The country that you were in. Yep. How long was that flight?
It was about 4 hours.
Okay.
Not bad.
Once you got there, were you where you were located, or did you have to drive in somewhere?
So we had to drive a little bit, just a little bit about the trip. We stayed in the capital, and we did trainings there, things like that. They had a guest house for us to stay in. And then we would leave the capital. We left the capital three times on three different treks, going out into villages and different areas of the country doing ministry work.
So the capital was the place where y'all were staying, and and that was kind of the hub.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how long was the trek?
A trek was about 10 days.
Yeah.
Anywhere from 8 to 10.
So you wouldn't be in the capital during the trek,
no,
though.
Yeah.
It was just a location where you all gathered
to
get training.
We spent about 3 days in between treks receiving training, and we had one rest day, and then we'd go back out.
I see. So that was the place you would kind of resupply,
mm-hmm.
gear up, get some quality rest maybe. And
maybe visit a hospital, get a test for a parasite or something.
Oh, yeah. I guess we should pause and explore that story a little bit. I know on stateside we were praying for you during that, but tell us a little bit about that. What happened?
Yeah, well, so after we got back from the first trek, Daniel Panzica, he had him a parasite. And he went and got tested, and it was a three-headed parasite that he had. And so
a three-headed parasite.
Appropriate for Daniel. Yeah. Which, by the way, is a FBC Brookhaven,
mm-hmm.
now in Hattiesburg.
Yeah.
An awesome young man.
Yeah.
So we got back from the second trek, and so there's this place in the capital. They had a bunch of cafes where you could get American food, and we ate there. The morning we were leaving that afternoon to go on our trek, we ate there that morning, and they had these really good hash browns. They were like cheesy. It was the best hash browns I've ever had. And so as we were leaving, we were like, when we get back, we're going back and we're getting those hash browns. Like, that's the first thing we're doing. So we got back, and I had this burger, and it was very undercooked. I think that's what did it to me. And so I was sick for 2 days. And it was actually the 2 days we were sick. It was the only time the entire time one of the missionaries made us a home-cooked meal, and I couldn't eat it because I was stuck, sick.
So I guess we would just say you got food poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, food poisoning.
Yeah. And that's just something you have to ride out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so a couple days.
Yeah, a few days.
So did you join the trek after you got better? Or did you stay on the trek?
Well, that was actually, we were in the city.
Okay,
so I missed a training. So.
I see.
So you had actually just gotten
back from a trek. Uh-huh.
So you were very fortunate because there were some other people that got it on the trek.
And that's really rough.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that begs a question. I've got this question. How long were you in South Asia?
I was there for 6 weeks.
So 6 weeks. So you had did three treks,
mm-hmm.
and a break or training in between. And when you would trek out, you would head in a different direction towards different village areas.
Yeah, so where we were, there's a bunch of different districts, so they would send out all of us to different districts. It was a unique trip in that we weren't, like, assisting the missionaries there. They were... It was four of us interns and two national partners, and they were sending us out on our own. Like, there was no guidance. That's what they told us from the very, very beginning, is that, like, they're not babying us on this trip. They're treating us as equals to help them get done the work that they have to do.
Now, how did you feel about that?
When I first heard about that, like, before I got over, I was definitely nervous because I was like, this is my first time out of the country, and you're telling me there's not even going to be a missionary
I have no leadership.
But, and the first trek, too, it was, there was things that you just run into things, they call them field realities that you just don't know what to deal with, where, you know, there's something unbiblical. You may run into, we didn't run into this, but you may run into a believer who has three wives or something. Yeah. And like, what do you do in those yeah. situations? But it was cool to see like how we gained, like we figured out what we were doing a little more each trek, to where by the third trek, like we were ready. We knew what was going on.
You had a lot of confidence. We understood, on the third.
Had confidence. And they said they wanted to do four treks, but it's just too long. But they said the idea with the fourth trek is they would let us plan it, like pick where you're going, pick like all of that stuff. Yeah. Let us plan it out completely. But we didn't get to do that.
Chris, I'm interested. Of course, I know part of the answer, but I think it'd be benefit, you know, whoever's listening. Tell us about the communication you had with your son halfway around the world during these 6 weeks.
Well, what's funny is you can watch people all the way across the world on Life 360. Mm. Yeah. If they have data.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we did a lot of texting in the family. Hey, Jeremiah's here. We see where he's back at the Capitol now. Mm-hmm. He's out in this barren, I don't, you know, just yeah. these different places. But we did have contact with him. I'm not sure if it's like maybe a couple of days after they had gotten there, and he, you know, we were able to, when he got back to the
Capitol,
he would usually FaceTime us, mm-hmm. and which I think really only happened, I guess, three times.
Yeah. And the first time it happened, there's this, so I go up on the roof of our guest house, and you go just get a great view of the city. And, but the whole summer there was this crow that lived up there, and he would like antagonize you. Like, so I got up there, and before I even got up on the phone, I just felt something like go behind my head, and I looked and I was like, it was this crow. He swooped behind me. And then while I was on the phone with them, I was up there for maybe like around an hour. He did it two more times. And then right at the end, he swooped down and he actually like hit me in the back of the head with his feet and attacked me. And so then I started running down they had the spiral staircase. I started going down the staircase and it hit me again. But yeah, every time, everybody in the house talked about that. There's that squirrel antagonist. We said it was a demon possessed squirrel.
See, y'all, this is the stuff we didn't get a chance to tell you on Sunday morning.
Demon possessed,
you know, about the demon possessed crow.
Yeah, the demon possessed crow. We could see. I remember, like I said, like that crow is about to hit you. Yeah,
it was crazy.
So, all right. So, Chris, you went from communicating with your son daily to having some stretch of period of time where, you know, it could have been a week.
Yeah.
8, 9, 10 days where you just mm-hmm. didn't know, other than I see a signal on Life 360, but that really doesn't tell you the,
yeah.
you know, the stats of your son. So
yeah, there's some funny thing. I mean, some things which honestly, I did a lot of praying.
Yeah.
You know, and during that time that Jeremiah was there, Qatar was bombed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, they're flying. That's where they're flying.
That's where they fly. Yeah.
That's where they fly in and out of. So I'm like, all right, what's this going to, you know, look like? And there's another funny story about that, because Jeremiah's grandmother, Anna Frances Havens, had some major concern. And so she hawked Sam Ivy down. Like, oh, she had, went through all these avenues to, and it come to find out she had a close friend who's like maybe Sam Ivy's mom or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so she called Sam and said, are you gonna send him back through Qatar? And so
she was concerned.
Yeah, there was some major concern. And he did say, hey, we're gonna make sure that we
yeah, they, They had a whole plan for if anything was like not safe. To, yeah, another way to get it.
This is one of the benefits, I think, of going with an established missions sending agency like the IMB.
Yeah.
You know, they have the bat phones to high dignitaries in every place and contingencies.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that they had a backup plan if things got hot in a certain area. They have ways to get you, you know, through or around or whatever it is. But what do you call Miss Anna?
Anna Francis?
Yeah. Mamaw? Grandmama?
Grandmama, yeah.
Grandmama was concerned, huh?
Grandmama was concerned, yeah. She, it was so funny hearing her tell that story about calling. She's like, don't be embarrassed that I called Sam. Yeah.
It's nice to feel loved, isn't
it? Yeah, but I think he told her, hey, we're going to take care of him, but he's going to want to stay with his team.
Yeah.
They're going to... Yeah. You know, they're going to want to be together.
You can't smuggle him out.
Yeah, you're not going to want to send him in a different direction than everybody else. So
let's talk a little bit. Let's flesh out a trek because we did hear, you know, a few of the specifics on Sunday morning, but let's record it and hear when you would go out on a trek. What did a day look like for y'all? Like, what time would you get up?
Mm-hmm.
How did you feed yourselves?
Yeah.
And then what was the work? How long was your day?
Mm-hmm. So whenever we're going out on a trek, one of the things about where we were is travel takes a very long time.
Okay.
So we would leave. We'd hop on a bus, a big bus. We'd hope it had air conditioning. And the bus rides were anywhere from about 14 to 20-something. I think the longest group ended up having a 40-hour bus ride because of some landslides and things like that just going through the mountains. But we had normally about anywhere from a 20 to 30-hour bus ride. We'd stay somewhere for the night, and then we'd go however far the next day, get where we were going. And we'd normally be staying with a local pastor or in a local church. And so... we'd get up, around 8 a.m., and it was a lot more, like, laid back in the treks than I was expecting. Like, I kind of thought we were going to be going 1,000 miles an hour, just, like, doing stuff constantly. But we'd wake up in the morning, we'd have our time to read our Bible. About 10 a.m., we'd have kind of a brunch, because they have two meals there, and it's this stuff, Dalbite, it's the same every single meal their whole lives pretty much. And what it is, it's like rice and this lentil bean soup, and then you'll have some vegetables and maybe some kind of meat thrown in there with it. But so you have that at about 10 a.m. and then we get going with the ministry. First trek, most of what we did was traveling to local churches and training believers, training them to share the gospel, training them in making disciples in church formation and things like that. And then we would maybe afterwards go out into those villages that the churches were in and share the gospel in those villages. And so, but then the second and third trek, we're doing just pretty much 100% going out every day, sharing the gospel. So, second trek, actually the pastor we were with, he was a workhorse. Like, we got there and he was like, he gave us some Dalbite. He's like, go rest for an hour and then we're going out. And then we went out for like 3 hours and shared the gospel all throughout his village. And a funny story with him is there was one time we shared with these five people and they rejected the gospel, didn't want to hear it. And so, we would move on, but we sat there with him and he was talking to them for like 30 minutes. And I was like, we need to move on. There are people who need to hear the gospel. And he stands up finally after 30 minutes and he goes, all right, we can go. They're coming to church Saturday. And so he had talked to him.
He waited them out.
He was busy. But every people we would come to, like, they would tell us, like, the pastor, he's been sharing this gospel with us, which was super encouraging to see that even in a place where so many haven't heard the gospel, there are also pastors that are just so crazy about getting the gospel into their villages and their communities. But we'd share the gospel for a few hours. We'd have a lunch break. and then really we'd just go out and share the gospel more. Like, that's really what this, they told us throughout this trip, like, you'll share the gospel more than you ever have in your life. I think the entire internship throughout the 6 weeks shared with 3,600 people, most of whom probably have never heard the gospel before. So on our third trek, we got to share the gospel in a village that had never been reached, never been shared before. And they, like, when we came to the first house, they knew what Christianity was. There were churches and villages in a close vicinity, but they didn't know the gospel. And so it was really cool to be able to, really cool and eye-opening, too, to be able to, well, it was cool to get to bring the gospel to them, but it's heartbreaking that, you know, they haven't had an opportunity to hear it yet.
Yeah, until
it was
that
cool
day
to be the one to get to bring it to them.
Yeah. So how were you received? You know, just obviously you had a translator there helping y'all.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, just if you've done foreign missions and you've done gospel presentations like that, you get more rejection than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's overwhelming. The rejection sometimes, but I've always been treated well. Mm-hmm. You know, were they kind?
They're very kind to us. Yeah. So, I mean, we'd walk up to houses. The way that we kind of joke about the first few people when we got to our first trek who we shared the gospel with, it was just very like we didn't know what was going on because it happened. Like how it would happen is we'd walk up to this house. Our national partner would say something in the language, and they'd turn to us and be like, all right, someone share gospel. And we were, the first time it happened, we were like, already? Like, this is, like, we thought, you know, maybe sit down, have a conversation with them, but no, it's just share the gospel.
Cold.
And so one of the guys, Cody, he shares the gospel. And then we go into the next house, and they say something to this family, and he looks at us and says, this man is a believer, but he is drinking. Do you have something to say to him?
Oh,
and we were like, no, really, no, I don't have anything. We just were very unprepared. But I mean, we got accustomed to it as time went on, but we were always received very well. The only time that we ever had anyone who like didn't receive us well, we went up to this, I guess it was kind of a bar. There were a bunch of men there drinking and we asked them if they wanted to hear the gospel and they just said they weren't interested. But there was, well, we faced some hostility.
Yeah. I mean, I know people would be interested to hear. I know the one moment when you were telling us this, I was like, whoa, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. What he's talking about is, so most people are going to be very friendly and you'll share the gospel with them and they'll probably say something like, oh, that sounds good, but I'm a Hindu or whatever. We were working mostly among Hindus. But, I mean, it is illegal to share the gospel there. And they said that there's been a growing Hindu nationalist movement recently. And so you will have people who, so for example, we went to this one village. We had to hike several hours to get there. We crossed over a river, which I say that to make it sound more dramatic. It was like ankle deep, but we crossed over a river.
Listen, you were fording a river.
Yeah, so... crossed over this river and we go into this village and we split off into three groups and we're just going through sharing the gospel. And I was at the second house, like we had barely been in this village, and our other team walks up and they're like, we got to get out of here right now. And we're like, what's going on? I said, this guy just came up and he just threatened to beat us and kill us. And so we're like, okay, well, we gotta go. So we left that house, start walking down the road, and we crossed past with him on the road, and he was just yelling at us, telling us that if he saw us at another house in that village, he would grab his friends and they'd throw us in prison, which you don't see any like prisons or anything. There was a prison in this village, which is like the only time I ever saw. I haven't even heard of that from anybody else. So there's that aspect of we're like, man, if we get thrown into this prison, there's no way to contact anybody.
Yeah,
everybody's going to get back to the capital and they're going to be like, where's group seven or whatever?
Yeah,
like, where's their group?
So we're at this village.
Yeah. So there was some hostility, but other than that, I mean, most people are very, very kind and they'll receive you. But
yeah. So, it sounds like that was your day. And I was interested. You said that they would, your translator, you called mm-hmm. him something else.
National partner.
Your national partner. You might be presented with, okay, this guy's a believer,
mm-hmm.
but he's got a drinking problem.
Yeah.
And the first time that you mm-hmm. encountered that, like, I wasn't prepared.
Yeah.
Did you get prepared though?
Because
I've experienced that too, where all of a sudden you're like, y'all, we got to go find all the scripture verses about alcoholism yeah. and being sober-minded, so we're ready for the next time.
Yeah, we didn't run into situations like that very often.
Yeah.
It was kind of I think it was just random that happened as the second house we went to. But I mean, I was like, okay, I need to be ready with what to say. And that happened in a lot of different ways. Like, you would have a lot of response from Hindus would be, this sounds good. Maybe one day I will believe, but either something to do with their family, maybe their family doesn't want to leave Hinduism or something like that. So they're like, well, I can't now. So I got into a very routine of whenever I would hear that, I would bring up the scripture. I think it's in 2 Corinthians where he says, today is the day of salvation.
Right.
And so we would kind of press them. And it was cool to see, like, one of the big things they wanted us to do in being there was to disciple our national partners. Because those are the guys that are, like, when you leave, they're still there doing work. Like, I still stay in contact with them. I talk to them about their ministries and stuff. And it was cool to see, like, this one guy we had, he only came on our third trek. But the first guy I shared with said that. And I said, today is the day of salvation. You don't know what will happen tomorrow. Why would you wait? What's causing you to wait? And then the next house I went to, they said the same thing. And he started talking to him. I didn't know what he was saying. And so, because I was prepared to say that today, will you tell him today's the day of salvation? And then he stopped and I was like, well, will you tell him? He's like, I already told him that. So, like, they'd pick up on what you were doing and they would do it too.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool to see.
Yeah.
So these national partners were basically college age.
Mm-hmm. They were all the guys we had were in their 20s.
Okay.
So some of them would be studying in the capital or things like that.
Yeah. And guys who had recently come to faith, maybe?
Our two main national partners, they both grew up in families that were believers, which was interesting to me because, I mean, that's not the case for most people.
Yeah.
But some of the other guys, yeah, they would be recently converted or just not super mature in their faith.
Would y'all have time as a team to kind of debrief, you know, and share your experiences amongst, you know, the different, and maybe learn from each other? And
Yeah, so they had us, whenever we got back to the Capitol, they had, the first day was just completely debrief.
Yeah.
And I think that was really good, especially for our team. Our team, all of our guys were just very laid back and relaxed.
Yeah.
So we didn't really do anything like that while we were out in the field, which I think it could have been beneficial to do, but we all were just kind of like, yeah, we're all right. Like, we're good. There's not too many
problems.
The reason
I ask is you came back,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're back in the statesides.
Yeah.
And now you're in front of, like, this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in a pastor's prayer meeting, Brother Chris sharing this warning that somebody gave to y'all about, like, not culture shock or
reverse culture shock coming
where
back to,
you know, you've left this world that moves at a much slower
mm-hmm.
and when I heard you say that, that's common anytime you leave the country where people they move slower than Americans,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there's just not as much stuff to distract you, or there's not as many toys or whatever. Well, you come back to America,
mm-hmm.
and tell us what that was like. You know, when Chris said it to us, I had never thought about reverse culture shock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you and I talked briefly about you had a moment of that.
Mm-hmm.
So how was it coming back home?
Initially it was very I was happy to be home, happy
relieved
to see my family. Yeah. But I got home and Sadie, my dog, she was super happy to see me.
Yeah.
And that was fun. Lilybelle told me that she, like, a lot of the days where I was gone, Sadie would go in my room like she was, like, looking for me or something. So that was fun to hear that. But, yeah, I think the first real, like, we were driving back from the airport. And I thought there's a song that one of the guys played while we were over there. It's called Jesus, You Alone. And so I told my dad to play it. That's like my favorite song right now. But like I was, that was really the first moment anything hit me of like, I was riding, listening to that song. And I was just thinking about, man, there are people over there who I've left who have never heard the gospel. And like I had to keep myself together to not break down in the car right there. And but then as well, coming back to church the first Sunday during the worship, it was another. A lot of the moments for me have been in worship. I don't know like why, because it's been different for different people, but for me it's been during worship, like that'll just the reality of the lostness of some of the areas of the world will hit me. Yeah. But in a way it almost makes like the worship more powerful and more beautiful, which is a cool thing. And then I went to Super Summer for a few days, and they always end Super Summer, the last song is I Ran Out of That Grave, and it's like everybody's hyped up, you know, jumping up and down and just having an awesome time, and it's a great thing, I love it. But we're sitting there and I was looking around at the room, and I saw the little red schoolers, all these little ninth graders. And I saw them, like, jumping up and down, having a great time. And at first, I got filled with all this joy of, like, man, I remember when I was where they are. And, like, thinking about, you know, how some of them may be in my shoes. And God may use them in the same way that he's used me. But then I began to think about, man, all the kids that I saw while I was over there. And I just broke down crying. Yeah. It's just, it's tough because, I mean, there's much ministry to be done in the United States, but the access is there, and the people can hear. If you want to hear the gospel in America, you can hear the gospel, but there are people on the other side of the world who, I mean, they don't have access. They're searching. I remember one of the missionaries told this story of they shared the gospel with this girl. And she accepted it. She believed in Christ. But she said, how long have y'all known in Europe about this? My father, he spent his whole life searching for the truth, looking for what was true, and he never found it. And he died. How long have y'all known? And they had to tell him, well, we've known for thousands of years. And so it's kind of like, well, where have we been? What have we been doing in those thousands of years that those 2,000 years since Jesus raised from the dead, that there are still people that haven't heard, when that was the final mission that he left us with, is go and reach all nations. So it's definitely hard, but also it's given me more focus and purpose in that if I am to go over there as on missions long term, like I know that's my goal, share the gospel with people. But if not, while I'm here, my goal is to share the gospel with people and prepare people, train people, and teach people about the need for missions. And there's this thing one of the guys told me while I was there, because I was talking to him about how I'm not sure if I'm called to pastoral ministry or missions. And he said, well, good pastors raise up good missionaries, and good missionaries raise up good pastors. And I've just been thinking about that as I've been back. And that's one of the things me and Landon really wanted to push with Love and Lincoln, is like, how can we open these students' eyes to see that there's more to life, to Christianity, than going to church on Sundays? So
one of the things, if y'all don't mind, I'll just share one little thought that I as you were talking about how you're really contemplative or introspective during worship.
Mm-hmm.
And missions, I remember this from seminary, Chris, you may have heard this, that missions can be thought of as worship recruiting,
mm-hmm.
where these people that you encountered in these villages and mountains, they're worshiping something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the wrong thing. And so you go with the gospel so that they can worship the right thing. The only thing that's worthy of worship.
Mm, yeah.
And so in a worship service, you're compelled, like, here we are, we're worshiping the right thing, and they're not.
Yeah.
And obviously, God deserves all praise, all worship, all glory, and he's not getting it from those. And part of the reason he's not getting it from those is they haven't heard.
Yeah.
And so that's a compelling reason. You know, hey, y'all are worshiping the wrong thing. And it's hard even when you share, you know, hey, the one true living God has sent me to you to tell you there's a right thing to worship, and this ain't it.
Yeah.
And they reject it.
Yeah.
That's tough.
That is.
It's tough. It's really tough. But God, you know, you have the Holy Spirit in you to dwell in you richly and comfort you and help you.
Yeah.
You know?
And one thing that was tough about that to see, sometimes you'd have people who would reject you and they'd say, we're strong Hindus and we want to stay that way. But sometimes you would have people who would say, well, I can't throw my idols because if I do, I'm afraid they're going to do something to me. They're going to harm me.
Worshiping the wrong
And so
thing.
They worship. Many of them are worshiping out of fear of their worshiping so that something bad doesn't happen to them. They're sacrificing so that something bad doesn't happen to them. And they're afraid to leave because they believe something bad might happen to them if they
have
do
a,
leave.
A story of one lady you shared the gospel with that said her daughter was a Christian. Yeah. But
so it was the second person I got to talk to while I was there on the first trek. And I shared my testimony with her very briefly, and then I asked if she wanted to hear more, and she said, no, my daughter is a Christian, and she visited my house one night, and all my goats died that night. And so she does not want to hear. She's afraid, basically believing that her gods are angry at her daughter for leaving and punishing her through that. And so, yeah, it's just... It's hard to see when they're worshiping and it's not even a worship out of they just love their
love.
God
yeah,
so
it's,
much,
yeah,
you know. And, but it's this fear that's holding them like captive.
It's the power of the enemy, you know, that he can take something that like we obviously see the fallacy of that or the trivialness of it, you know, on this side of faith.
Yeah.
Where they it's a lesser thing. It's a lesser thing to give your attention to or give worth to.
Yeah.
Fear, idols, whatever it is, than the one true living God. And but it's our call, you know, the commission, the Great Commission is as much about obedience as anything. We are called to go and to make disciples of all nations. But ultimately it's the work of God in a person's heart. And so not that we have to feel good, but we should feel okay that we are obeying the Great Commission. And that should bring some joy to our lives, you know. So, well, look, as we're wrapping up here, I really appreciate y'all's time. I know y'all've got a busy afternoon. Any final thoughts or final word? Brother Chris, you got anything you want to wrap up and say?
Not really. The only thing I could say is I, even through some difficult moments, I knew that God was in control. And I think, you know, as a parent, you have to come to a place where you're like, hey, my son is an adult and he's where God wants him to be. And that's the safest place he can be.
Wow.
And I would say just one thing on the talking about the hardship of being rejected with the gospel, because that's something my team dealt with so much. We shared the gospel with 350 people this summer, and one person came to faith, and it was actually the last person that we shared with the whole trip. A comfort that I took is I couldn't tell you where it is, but in the Old Testament somewhere, God tells us that his word does not return void, but that it accomplishes every one of his purposes. So even in the rejections, I know that God is working in that. And I know I have confidence that many people we talk to, just from how they responded to the gospel, the interest they had, or the, you know, that many more will come to faith from that through those seeds, through more faithful believers coming and sharing. And so.
Yeah, we, you know, we would love to see some instant results. It doesn't seem that we get that all the time, you know, and praise God for the one.
Yeah.
And that makes it worth it. So, well, guys, with that, we're going to sign off. And so this completes, for the listening audience at home, episode 5 of, again, what I'm calling the FBC Brookhaven podcast. Original. So original. But, hey, Brother Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brother Jeremiah, thanks.
Thank you.
With that, we'll sign off. Bye.
We'll see y'all.